Consulting company. We mostly do application security consulting company or application security consulting, but we've recently been involved in responding to a bunch of attacks that people have been labeling in the media the advanced persistent threat. We're not always totally sure which attacks are all in the same family, and that's part of the attacker's goal is to keep some of that obfuscated from us. But there's definitely some common threads and some interesting similarities between a bunch of these attacks.
Can you speak louder, please?
Oh, sure. Yeah, thanks. So there's been a bunch of similarities between some of these attacks, and they've gotten this name, the Advanced Persistent Threat name. I'm not in love with that name, but you know, when you're dealing with an adversary, they don't always have the kindness to label themselves and clearly differentiate, like, oh, this is me and Jim, and that's Tim and Bob, and we share one exploit, but nothing else, or whatever. Right? They're going to hide themselves. So I'm going to talk a little bit about some of the things that we've seen here, and maybe how we can protect ourselves, what this kind of means to us. Some of it is a little bit, you know, people get very excited when there's a whole new wave of attacks, especially when the attackers are doing something clever. We've seen so many phishing scams in places where people grab and run with credit card numbers. You know, it's kind of refreshing sometimes to see attackers that build their own malware and seem to kind of know what they're doing. You know, it makes a lot of people in the industry very excited about it, and that's not, you know, that's easy to get carried away with. So, you know, there's all kinds of products, and people make marketing claims. So, I guess I'm going to capitalize on that a little bit and use this as an opportunity to get invited to talk to you. But I'm also going to hopefully help explain what we've found to be useful in countering these, and maybe give you some ideas for how you might work to counter these kind of problems in the future. So. For an agenda here, I'm going to start with just an example attack walkthrough. Then I'll talk a bit about prevention and mitigation approaches and the lessons that we can kind of draw from that. And then we can open it up for discussion if you have questions. I'd love to take some of those and talk a little bit about that. I should also add that I really appreciate ProIdea bringing this conference together. It's a great conference, and it's my second time at Confidence, and I'm having a great time, and I hope you are all enjoying it too. There have been some fantastic talks. All right, so here's an example walkthrough. One of the things about the Aurora attacks is that, or these APT attacks in general, is that they've gotten a lot of press for being from China. And, you know, there's reasons that we think that they're from China. It's pretty easy to make things look like they're coming from China. You can't be absolutely certain until you've caught people that is in particular. But the examples I'm going to use are going to, you know, put going to use Shanghai as a little example here. So one of the things that's interesting about APT attacks is that they seem to start with spear phishing of someone in a remote office. So spear phishing is a lot more dangerous than regular phishing, because if you saw one of these messages, it'd be crafted specifically for you. It actually engages you. You have some reason why you want to click it, and then you maybe have some browser vulnerability or something that it's going to try to exploit. But the important thing about this is it isn't just some mass thing that's being mailed out to everyone. Your spam filter isn't going to see this. There's not going to be a signature for it in all the commercial products, because they're targeting this specifically to the people that they want to exploit. And it's not really clear from this slide. One of the things that's particularly scary about APT attacks is that they tend to target people that aren't necessarily the end victim. They target someone who is a friend of that end victim. And then once they've got that person on the line, they go after the person who has the rights that they want or who can access the system that they're interested in. So, there it is. A little PowerPoint animation. Once they've got their spear phishing done, they establish a little control channel. And note, this is all in this overseas office here. So I've broken this down in sort of a, you know, we have a production network, maybe in the United States. We have a corporate network for the company. And we have a Shanghai office. You can imagine, like, maybe some kind of facility that's out in another country. It wouldn't have to be necessarily Shanghai, but that makes for a good example. So once they've taken control of a person, they do something like they do an NTLM attack, and they target the domain controllers. And one of the nice things about these nice big enterprises that share one big domain across many countries is that the DC in Shanghai has the same credentials in it as the DC in your corporate headquarters. So that's not necessarily a good place to be, right? Because if you're able to compromise this, you have access to the same information that you need to log into any of the other components in the system. Once the DCs are compromised, they can do things to get access to the other systems. So one thing that's been a theme is VPN access. VPN access is a really easy way for an attacker to get into a system because it's designed to be easy, it's designed to be remote, it's designed to get everywhere. You know, this might be part of your response procedures if there's a problem in a production system, or it might be how legitimately administration is done on your corporate network. And once they're in to the other areas now, they have the opportunity to explore. And they want to do that quietly because they don't want to get caught. But the kind of exploration that we're most concerned about in the APT that kind of separates it from a normal attack, not that it's always easy to tell when you can say that, you know, one's one, the other, but, you know, they might be more interested in the CFO's email or in, financial information or something of longer term value than necessarily grabbing and running with data that's easily sold. Once they do, so they find something that that's worth taking, they exfiltrate it, and they take it all home. I'll go into a bit more detail about how some of those steps look. But first, I just want to talk a little bit about what is one of the separations between this and just a regular break-in, because in a certain sense, I don't necessarily believe that there's a huge difference. I mean, we've been dealing with people breaking into networks for years and stealing things, but often, they go for the easy things to monetize. One of the things that's really scary to me, having seen a lot of internal applications, is that these attackers aren't necessarily going for the simplest thing to monetize. There's a great story in the Christian Science Monitor in January about some oil companies, and the oil companies were having this problem where when they spent a ton of money investigating, doing geological research, they'd find some area that they wanted to buy the mineral rights for, and they'd make their bid, and these other countries, in the Christian Science Monitor article, the countries were Chinese oil companies, would come in with a very mysteriously timed bid that was just better than theirs, and they believed that this was partly the result of industrial espionage, that sort of sensitive information that could, instead of monetizing some credit cards that maybe make you a few thousand dollars over the course of weeks, that might be the kind of thing that shifts the balance of power over years or causes, over 50 years, billions of dollars. So that's a much more scary kind of attack. So the kind of things that these attackers are looking for, sensitive source code. You know, if you've got your closed source obscurity protected applications, maybe their source code wouldn't be the best thing to have in an attacker's hands, especially an attacker that's trying to break into other people's systems too. Future product information, that could be valuable. Third-party information that's hosted at the victim, especially if you're thinking about cloud providers, that would be a big issue. Credentials for production systems. So one thing about most attackers, they love to grab credentials for systems, but they don't necessarily need to understand the systems that they're on, and often they can't. So it's kind of scary when someone starts targeting production credentials. You often hear this analogy. People will look at you with a straight face and they'll say, "Our network is like an egg. It's really hard on the outside, but it's kind of gooey on the inside." And I think that's a great analogy because, you look at all of the software out there and, the history of our operating systems, our browsers, our plugins, they don't go months at a time without serious vulnerabilities. And, you know, an egg is probably about the right level of security, right? Like, if you ever drop or flick an egg, you'll find that the shell is not as protective as, I don't know, say the canisters we use to store nuclear waste, right? That might be something better to protect your very sensitive information. Anyway, this GUI inside includes executive email, customer information, and often resources that people could use to explore to find out what's in there without necessarily being too overt. So the kind of connecting point here is that there's a scary lack of targeting of the easy monetized data. And I'm not talking about any one particular company, although certainly one has stepped out and talked a lot about its experiences in public, which I think is a great thing. So social engineering. So the first step of these attacks, I'm just going to go through them in a little bit more detail so we can talk about each of the issues, because if we're going to think systematically about mitigating them, we better break it down a little bit. So, social engineering. Well, there's some dots that are supposed to appear here, but there it is. All right. So, first step is reconnaissance that's performed by attackers, probably through social networks, but maybe through mailing lists, public posts, presentations. And one of the things that's really interesting about this, and one of the things that lets you know what country maybe attackers are coming from, is the language that they choose their victims, to target their victims in. I don't know if you've ever received the, like, broken English, or if you're a native English speaker, what to me is an obviously, you know, broken English letter from someone in Nigeria that's the mass market kind of scam trying to trick you into things. And, like, the number one hint might be that real people don't type in all uppercase, right? Certainly people that are educated, like princes are educated, like, don't, they have, you know, the nuance about shift. So that you can kind of discard those messages. Well, attackers who are working in their native language are going to be a lot more persuasive. And so if you're an attacker, you're probably going to target someone who you can have a really good chance of tricking them. So that might mean that you know, you are going after the branch of an office that is in a country where the language that they speak is the language you speak. So you want to target an American company, you find an office of theirs in China, and you have a much better chance of being able to speak fluent Mandarin to the people and trick them into believing some plausible story about why they should click something or perform that spear phishing attack. You can worry about getting to where the good stuff is later. So, you know, you don't need to necessarily start off by attacking the most important person in the enterprise. In fact, it might be good to start with that person that no one cares about at the company, that person on the frontline support or who doesn't have technical sophistication, so that you can find a good patsy and then elevate privileges, because you know it's this very strong egg design, and you know that can work to your benefit, because once you get in, you can worry about getting to the interesting stuff. And you know, finding and exploiting a non-technical friend of targets is another really you know, a thing that makes us think that some of these attacks are connected, right? Because this isn't necessarily the way that a lot of attacks normally happen, right? You just kind of go after people. But when you've got something that you're really interested in, if there's, you know, a large sum of money, if you're a professional, it's reasonable for you to do a little research to maybe figure out who it is that you would target to trick someone else who's in a position to access the data you want. So turns out that we use trusted communication mechanisms all the time. I get a, you know, email from someone, and I know damn well that email is not secure. And, you know, you get something on Facebook or through Twitter, and you really do think, hey, this is a trusted communication. You don't look at that address bar and think, oh, HTTP, why should I trust anything that comes over that? No, you think, oh, my mom is having a problem with her computer, because I trust my mom, and even when she comes to me over an insecure channel, I don't think twice about that. So these, this is kind of like a human nature element that can be really used to lure someone into an attack site or hostile content. So this is an example of what you might see in a social network. And this is a victim chosen totally at random, not a victim, an example of who you might want to attack, chosen at random from one of the many places that are interesting, certainly not someone that we're working with on this problem. And you can just see, so it was a time when I wanted to attack somewhere, I would run an nmap scan and I'd see, oh, let's see what the network is like. Let's see what resources this company has on the internet, right? I'll just find their address space, I'll go through it, I'll say, oh, look, they've got an LDAP server and they've got a bunch of websites and some FTP servers and some Cisco routers. This is really interesting. I'm going to figure out their whole infrastructure. Well, that's not really the way it is anymore. You can, you know, the new nmap is LinkedIn and social networks, right? You don't need to, you know, look at the actual infrastructure. Instead, you can look at the social structure, who it is that has the positions of power in this, who they're friends with, who their non-sophisticated friends that they know through their curling club are, and that would be, you know, as effective as the 90s or the nmap scan of the new century or something. So, once you've got some idea of who you're going to target, and maybe you're starting with their weak friend, and now you've moved into the actual victim you're interested in, or someone who works at the company you're interested in, then you're going to do an attack to try and figure out how to exploit these people. And this is another way that these attacks are more sophisticated than traditional attacks. So, historically, we've seen this. You know, I just exploit everyone who comes to my website, I set up a botnet, and even if I compromise thousands of people at important companies, there's no realization that that's a particularly valuable resource because it's deep inside a corporate network. No, it's just another node on my botnet. When I sell access to it, I just sell access to them all. With something like this, they're not interested in getting numbers, they're interested in getting quality. So they're not going to start by trying their best exploit right off the bat. That's likely to be stopped. So what you do is, or what the attackers are doing is, they're doing an in-memory exploit. In-memory exploits don't write to the disk. They don't do all kinds of things that trigger HIDs and trigger IDS or antivirus systems. Things that are easy to hook for malware detection systems, you just don't do. You just perform an exploit in memory and gather a bunch of information about the site and about this company's employees setup, right? One of the things about well-run infrastructures is they tend to have a monoculture, because a monoculture allows you to do things like consistently deploy patches, consistently deploy updates that actually work, that don't cause your important infrastructure stuff to break, have antivirus on every machine. So instead of going straight for the kill, they go in there, they gather up the process list on the machine, they gather up the process token, figure out who they're able to, like what this is going to get them if they target this person. You know, is this a domain admin or is it just someone who has low rights access to their own workstation? Are they a member of any groups that are in a domain? Is this someone worth targeting at all? And then they take that information and they go off. And there's often a big gap between this initial process and the time when they actually go back and target someone. And that allows the attacker to invest some time and money in the attack, download those AV products, figure out what versions of the protection systems that they have in, the versions of the browsers they're running, the plugins that they have, test and enhance their exploit until it's able to bypass those things. And that's a very powerful, it's a powerful thing that lets you be pretty confident when you come back that you're actually going to be successful in not being detected. And that's also an interesting thing because it lets you, in a sense, as a defender, know that if you're able to keep your infrastructure being updated, roll out tools more quickly than them, you can at least make that more difficult. Once they've got a good exploit, they send them a link, they perform the exploit. Again, they're using their social networking tricks. And it can actually be done against a totally different employee. You don't necessarily need to target the same person. If you're pretty confident that they've got nice monoculture, you can just target the next person. And that is sadly the byproduct of a well-run IT environment, right? It's very hard to make an argument for not having a monoculture. You're going to invest a lot of money in all these defenses. You don't want them to have holes. It's, you know, rolling out similar images to everyone makes a lot of sense. Another thing that is consistent here is that have been some common control channels or common behavior among the control channels that we're seeing in different attacks. So initial exploit, this is not the initial thing that's used to profile the person, but the actual initial exploit, once they're on there, drops malware onto the machine, installs files or creates a new service, but generally its goal is just to assume local administrator rights to make it so that it's able to move out from there. Then a common thread is the use of dynamic DNS to find control servers, and then contacting that control server over a TLS-like protocol. And that's kind of spooky too, because network encryption is one of the things that's been our friend, and I don't like telling people not to allow unencrypted encrypted traffic out of their network, because that's one of the big defenses that we have. But you know, here we have it being used kind of against us because we can't as easily audit what's being done over those TLS connections. Although we certainly can see the DNS traffic, and we can figure out who's been making those kinds of connections if we've got some tools installed. The next step, and this is a very general step, it's the elevating privilege step, and it's obviously very specific to a particular environment, but you know, wanting to get domain administrator access or equivalent is a common theme here, and pulling down AD databases and cracking them is a common attack approach. Actually, in a sense, kind of a strange attack approach, if you think about it, because a lot of AD databases, like a lot of password authenticators, as they're stored on systems, are actually password equivalent under some common authentication protocols like NTLM. So you don't necessarily even need to crack them, but it is a common step, and you really do see people doing it. So it's another thing you can look for. Escalating privilege. So sometimes we don't know exactly how people did this. Sometimes it's pretty clear. So I'll just talk about a couple of the different ways that this can happen, and it's certainly not exhaustive. One is the use of local shared accounts. So local shared accounts, if you have XP images that you roll out to everyone's desktop, and IT made a nice DVD, and they just install that thing, and it's always got this admin account on it, and you know the password, but you'd never tell anyone, yeah, that's not a good idea, because that means that every machine has in its SAM a password equivalent to the local admin password for every other box on your network, and that makes it really easy to just move from machine to machine to machine. And that's that means anyone who compromises any machine on the enterprise can take over all the other machines that are similarly configured. That's really not a great idea. So this is a common thing to have for backup patch management and software distribution systems. And these things are made by tons of companies. And some of them are big names that have lots of people do serious security reviews. And some of them are from, you know, even famous security companies. And, you know, they have great protections. And some of them are little tiny fly-by-night shops that have no idea how to do this kind of stuff. Sadly, I've worked on some of these tools in the past. And you know, when I was writing administration tools, there were certainly things I didn't realize about password equivalence. It's a very tricky and nuanced area of Windows system management. It's very easy to build, say, a backup system that puts an account with the same credentials on every machine in the enterprise. Now, hopefully you do that. The accounts at least have machine-generated passwords because they never need to be entered by humans. Sometimes, though, people use they repurpose an account that they know already has the access it needs to perform the administrative task that they need to do. Pretty dangerous. And of course, these are also vulnerable to pre-computed dictionary attacks. The other attack type that we've, or another attack type that we've seen evidence of is the cracking of local cached domain accounts. So when you log in with a domain account to a server, a Windows server, you leave a cached, it's not a copy of your password, it's a verifier of your password. And it's actually kind of clever. It doesn't leave that password equivalent thing I was just complaining about on the machine. That would be a real bad idea. But it does leave enough of it that you can perform a brute force attack. And that's really helpful because if you log into a machine and then the next time you log into it, it's not able to talk to the DC, it's able to realize, oh yeah, you're that same person with that domain account that logged in yesterday. I cached that. It's only 10, so there's some limitations there. Like, obviously, there's an attempt here to limit this. It's stored in the security hive with the rest of the security stuff. but you can still crack them, even though it's an authenticator that's not password equivalent. So this is a lot closer to the kinds of passwords you find, password verifiers you find on Unix systems, where they aren't themselves password equivalent under the authentication protocols that are being used. So here's an example privilege escalation. First thing is that, so you've got a couple of different options here. You can perform a downgrade on an admin login. You can perform a downgrade on an automated process, or you can perform some pass the hash or pass the ticket attacks. I'm just going to give an example of that. One of the things that's really scary about this kind of attack is that when you perform an attack like this, you don't need to make any noise. Like, here's an IT admin server that's coming to your machine to check your patch status or to check what versions of software you're running or to, you know, check your registry or do some maintenance task that might be even part of what you have to do to secure your enterprise. And as part of that, it's going to do some SMB operations, right? So it's going to mount up that nice little C dollar sign, Sharon, because you're in a nice enterprise network where you're inside that egg. Maybe you've turned off those personal firewalls that ship on all those Windows versions so that people can share files. That's a real common configuration, especially if you have to have some kind of management system that's based on SMB. So the servers reach out to you, and if you've compromised that machine, you can turn around, and when they try and mount that share, you can say, oh yeah, you know, Kerberos is really nice and it's got great crypto and everything, but you know, today I only support NTLM. Would that be cool with you guys? Is that sweet? Here's a challenge, by the way. And the server says, oh yeah, that's cool. I hate it when I can't connect to the DC, and so I have to downgrade to NTLM. Why don't we just go your way? And that lets you take that NTLM hash off and do a brute force attack on it. And depending on the details, you might be able to do a pre-computed brute force attack, although that's not something that I think... Anyway, so cracking hashes. So NTLM is like a little thing for me, and so I get excited when I get to talk about it in respect to something that is actually happening in the real world. So cracking hashes is something that you used to have a supercomputer for, or there was a great presentation this morning by Hikari where he talked about the PDP-11 requiring a second to do 25 rounds of DES, and how his company's little box does more like a trillion in a second. So that's pretty cool. Obviously, computers have gotten faster. But also, the modern supercomputer looks a little bit more like a PlayStation and a little bit less like a thing that has its own cooling stack. So you get a couple of SLI video cards, and all of a sudden people are performing hundreds of millions. David Holton's talk is great, covers this. The other thing that you can do is you can spin up a supercomputer in the cloud. So you go over to your favorite cloud computing provider, and this one I think is an image from EC2, but I'm not trying to say that they're the only one. It's obvious that you can spin up a supercomputer on any cloud computing provider and have it run crack hashes for you all day. I've talked to friends that work in cloud computing environments when they chase down the machines that they're shutting down because of fraud, like someone stole credit cards or whatever, and they tell me that they find a huge number of rainbow tables. That's a really common theme, is rainbow tables, to find those when you're cleaning up. So, not great. Other ways you can escalate privilege? Logging keystrokes on a terminal services login. If you're sitting there, you own this machine, people are going to reach out and touch your machine. That's a great opportunity for you to just passively log what they tell you the credentials are. Now you don't need to do any of that complicated cracking. That was a hassle anyway. And then, of course, you can always do this thing that attackers have always done historically, which is attack unpatched or poorly configured services. And that is not the most popular technique in this kind of attack, but it certainly happens. And why do you think it is that an attacker wouldn't want to do an nmap once they've broken in with a custom exploit that they wrote specifically because they know it's going to get past your particular configuration, and they've spent some real good engineers, really big amount of time building that just for you? Well, maybe because this is super loud and you're likely to get caught if you start doing this kind of thing. Now, if you're lucky, maybe the victim doesn't have internal network monitoring and you'll get away with it, but it's not a really good plan, not a good survival strategy. Maintaining access. So issuing VPN credentials for multiple or accounts, either cracked accounts that are real legitimate people. So if you're looking through the directory, you're like, there's no bad guys here. Or create new accounts. That's a pretty big risk. Breaking into access control servers and creating their own soft tokens. So everyone has two-factor auth, and that's all great. But the idea of soft tokens makes it so that the process of issuing these things isn't as painful as you think it was going to be when you designed it, right? One of the big advantages of two-factor auth is that you know that someone actually has to get a token shipped to them. So it's kind of hard to do that if you're like, oh yeah, I'm at evil.com. Why don't you ship that to me? Did you have a question? No, okay, sorry. And then, of course, you can maintain access just by installing Trojans on multiple machines. That default admin share, it's once you've got domain admin access, that's a really easy way to go out there and keep it. You don't have to be all fancy and do complicated stuff in the directory. You know, just copy bad software into places where it'll automatically run. Exploring the system for sensitive data. So this is a place where it would be really easy to get caught and where I would like to catch people who are doing this kind of thing. Unfortunately, intranets are designed to make it easy to figure out who's who, right? There's directories in there. That's what directory services are for. That means that it's easy to tell who the build engineers are. And if I'm interested in source code, maybe I should look at a build engineer. It's easy to tell who the production management people are because it's listed, I'm the product manager. I bet that person knows the release information. In fact, you might, from reading their email, get a better idea of what the release cycle is than their boss does. Financial data. It's pretty easy to figure out who the people are that do the bookkeeping if you're in the directory. And then lawful intercept access has gotten some press for being another target. Taking control of key laptops with admin creds. So you've got people that we see on maybe our LinkedIn profile are important, and you can target their particular machines, and maybe they use those machines not just on the corporate network, but somewhere where it doesn't have good egress controls. Performing DNS lookups for standard intranet names. It's really not very suspicious to be performing a lot of DNS lookups. Most people don't audit their DNS, and there aren't a ton of tools out there. I wish I could just point you to some product that I could recommend that did great DNS analysis, but you kind of have to build your own. There are some great tools I can talk about for doing that, but you're going to have to do a little bit of scripting yourself. Using credentials to create source code enrollment. That's trouble. Step 7, getting the actual goods out. So obviously, if your attacker is just targeting someone's email, like if the kind of information you have is like in that Christian Science Monitor story where, someone's reading email, there's not going to be an exfiltration event to check for, right? If, on the other hand, someone's trying to copy off all of your product information for some upcoming release or company sensitive data, databases, giant extracts from production systems, anything like that is going to be, you're going to be in a good position to put some defenses in place. So what an attacker can do is find a server that they want to stage the information on, move the data. If you've got a enterprise that has operations in North America and operations in Asia, the connection that you're going to get through your intranet on the WAN, it's going to be a lot better than the kind of connection you're going to get over the internet, right? You can get a really nice high-speed leased line connection. And so it's pretty easy for an attacker to move those big sums of data all to one staging point. And then they can test for the outbound protocols that are allowed, figure out what the egress filtering or rules are that apply, move all of the data to the place where it's easiest to get it out from, or maybe where it's nearest to them so they can get a nice fast internet connection. And that might be EC2, that might be some server that's physically close to them. It all depends on what your egress situation is on your intranet. And then instead of slowly taking stuff out over the course of the intrusion. Wait until you've got everything you want in one place and pull it all out at once. And that's really scary because there are things that you can do. You can use something like NetWitness, say, that might tell you if someone's taking social security numbers out. But if you get a note like, oh yeah, someone moved all of the social security numbers out while you were out this weekend, like, that would not be the kind of thing that you can act on. Bye, horse. So, all right. So, changes in mitigations, reacting to this. So, I'm going to use an analogy to the Drake equation. The Drake equation is this equation that was formulated by this guy, Frank Drake, in 1961. It's to estimate the number of intelligent species in the galaxy. And it also has the connotation that what I'm saying is not scientific, which you should definitely read into this. It doesn't mean that it's nonsense, but I wish that it was firmer. It's also kind of cute. There's this guy, Peter Backus, and he recently used the same kind of a derivation of this formula to explain his lack of a girlfriend, so I like that. He actually published a paper, and it's very, like, science-y looking. He's at Cambridge. Anyway, the formula here is R, this giant number of stars in our galaxy, and then a bunch of little numbers that you multiply by it to reduce the size of the number of civilizations that you're going to actually find. So there are things like, how many of those stars have planets? How many of those planets are in a range where you could have liquid water? How many of those support life? How much of that life's intelligent? How long does it take for intelligent life to extinguish itself? How long does it take for it to develop to the point it can get radio technology? The important thing about these numbers is that they're small, and that as you make more conservative assumptions about them, the number of intelligent life forms we expect to find in the universe goes down. So each step has this probability of, in our case, in this analogy, an attacker is coming into your environment. They could either be detected or fail. In that social engineering step, there's a chance that that'll fail. The exploitation, the control channel establishment, the escalating of the privileges, the finding of that sensitive data, and that exfiltrating. So we, as defenders, simply want to make each step as hard as possible so that we can slow attackers down and make the odds of success less likely or more likely to result in us getting informed about what's going on and being able to stop it. You know, if we see something like this going on, we can do really disruptive things that we won't do normally. We can shut down production systems and take strong action that we don't want to take without really good cause. So lowering the value to make the odds less successful. So let's just go through each one of those and talk about some of the things that I think are effective here. And I should say we also published a paper on this in January, which I'll give you a link to, that talks about some of this in a little more detail. So at the social engineering level, there's only so much training you can do for end users, right? People are gonna, like, it almost doesn't matter how much you train me. My mother tells me to do something, I'm going to do it because she's my mother. So it's hard to train out of me some of the social impacts of networking technology. So, you know, maybe this is not the panacea. We can take some non-technical steps here. I think probably better than trying to train everyone in the world to understand how the internet works and HTTPS and whether or not a message from Facebook is really from your mother is to let people know the kinds of things they should be looking for that look fishy. When people actually think, hey, there's something wrong here, my mother doesn't use that word, she doesn't talk like that, or she speaks French, and this is in English or, you know, Chinese or something, have a process to follow up on that. And I know that sounds really simple, but very few places have a process for if an employee, like, thinks that they've been attacked, for them to report it. Like, hey, I'm a really smart person. I even have, you know, super high right access to a bunch of our infrastructure. I'm so important. Someone just sent me what I think was a really targeted scam. What do I do with that information? Well, I could, like, try and figure it out myself, but oh, I've got this job and I will not be treated very well by my boss if I do some other job instead of the job I'm supposed to do. So they have to have some way to take that, report it, and the company has to have a way to follow up on it. And so running faster than the other guy is not really fast enough in this scenario. Really, you have to be able to run faster than the bear. And so that means you're going to have to be able to give the edge that you have by having smart employees some chance to give you a benefit, right? It's really frustrating when you find out after the fact that you had a warning. Initial exploitation, that's a topic where there's tons of products out there. Tons of people will sell you magical pills to reduce the attack surface of your system. Some of these are really common sense. Some of them make the situation worse. So one thing that you can look at is attack surfaces like Flash, Acrobat, Java. You can try and reduce that. Now, you still need to have a business, so that might mean that you try to run something like Litzablitter. I don't know if I said that right. Right, but that's an attack prevention technology from FX. It interferes with a lot of Flash applets, but it might be useful. HIDs, antivirus, all these things are, they might extend that period of time it takes to take to write an exploit that gets past them. But a targeted exploit is unlikely to be impossible given an infinite amount of resources. But if we can push up that resource curve, we can maybe reduce that coefficient in our Drake's equation. Frequent updates and patches can help. If attackers can just use some currently unpatched bug that's on full disclosure, then all they need to do is worry about making it so it doesn't trigger your antivirus or your HID systems. And that gives them a big advantage. So, keeping those windows small. Also, that means that you have to re-QA your attack payload if you're trying to attack someone. Using an alternative browser is a tricky question. An alternative browser like Opera or Safari might seem like a good idea, but it might not be. Like, I know that I reported this bug in the Opera version for the Sharp Zaris a really long time ago, where they weren't doing CNAME validation on HTTPS, and that's totally unrelated to this, but they never patched it. And I feel like if I'd have reported that to Firefox, that they really would have, right? And so you've got something like a mainstream browser like Opera, like Firefox, you might get a little bit more traction. You might get a little more security review. You might just be in a better position. Conversely, it might be harder to find exploits for a browser like Opera just because it's so rare. Chrome is definitely, it has a whole security story about why it has superior security features. Some people have shown it to be it perform well in Pwn to Own and other kind of anecdotal things. It's a hard thing. A good web proxy is something that I feel very dubious about recommending, but web proxy authentication is awfully terribly weak, and you should never protect something like internet access that isn't itself sensitive. Like, you're not trying to protect your systems from accessing people from accessing the internet. Or if you are, then you've got really serious problems because, you can buy these little 3G modems and get on it really easily. That's not a good use for your domain credentials, right? You don't want every user's system on your network to be blindly authenticating to the web proxy 1,000 times a day. That's not a success strategy, especially when web proxy authentication systems tend to be weak. Or weaker than they should be. So, a good web proxy could help. Certainly, it's a mixed bag. Short-term mitigation. So another thing to look at is the command and control channel. So network forensics, these tools are definitely something people want to sell, and they can help. You can use them to figure out what someone's been doing, maybe to track down access after the fact. That also is a honeypot for an attacker, so kind of a dangerous thing if you're worried that your AD's been compromised. Maybe the easiest thing is to go after the forensics tools. So, people air gap these sometimes. They do other kind of extreme measures, which I think is really prudent. One thing I like about some of these tools, I really like it when you build an IDS system and you use it in a mode where all you detect is violations of your policy. So you're always going to encrypt a certain kind of communication. It can flag you on that just as easily as it can flag you on some complicated fancy thing. That actually can be very helpful because accidental misconfiguration is a really common cause of issues. Web proxies that I just bagged on actually are kind of essential if you want to stop a TLS-based command and control system. You need to have some way to get in the middle of that traffic and see what's going on. DNS logging. This is a really powerful tool. If you turn on DNS logging, you can store very small amounts of information that talk about who everyone on your network's actually trying to talk to, including all those dynamic DNS providers, which is one of the signatures that we talk about in that paper I talked about earlier. DNS logging, if you can build some tools to analyze it, like you take a tool like Splunk or one of the log analysis tools and you go in there and you look at it, you can see, hey, we never used to have people accessing these weird servers and now consistently things that we care about are. That's a scary thing. And that can also help you find other people that are under the control of the same attackers. Audited VPN provisioning. If you are able to make VPN provisioning very difficult and heavily audited, that can be very helpful also, because that is a very attractive channel, obviously, for an attacker. Data loss and prevention tools, proxy log monitoring, those can help. All offices have to have egress restrictions, right? One of the, you know, if you've got like, oh, well, we really don't trust people in our call center because they're always going to be browsing the web, so we have super strict egress controls, but, you know, oh, over here, we don't care at all about it. It's like, that's just asking for trouble. The security operations center that has people that are ready to react to tips about things where people think they're being specifically targeted, another great thing. Short-term mitigation. Sorry, I'm running low on time here, so I'm going to have to go a little quick. But auditing for... So escalation is a really hard thing to stop, right? You're inside this egg, and you know, you've got these tools that help you, right? You've got your vulnerability management tools in Circle, Rapid7, Tivoli, patch management, event log aggregation systems, license compliance systems. All of these things have to magically reach out and do single sign-on authentication to all the other things or all the machines on your network, right? That process of doing that is risky. And so these things give you a security benefit, and there is a security cost, and you want to make sure that you run them with the principle of least privilege in mind. You don't just want to say, oh, well, I'm going to use domain admin creds for all those machines. If you've got a service on your machine, and that service is running as a domain account, you have to think that maybe an attacker can see the password that was typed into that dialog box for the service, right? That's the kind of thing that you can extract with sophisticated malware. And certainly you can inject threads into any processes running like that if you compromise the local system account. It just makes sense. If that token exists in any process on the system, an attacker who's compromised the system is going to be able to use that token for their end. So you don't want to have a bunch of super high rights things performing services that aren't giving you a very clear benefit and that aren't running with the fewest privileges they can. And then GPO is a really powerful tool. If you have LM hashes, you probably don't need to be here right now. This is the kind of stuff you can enforce. LDAP signing, this is a bugbear of mine. I am a little disappointed that LDAP signing isn't enabled by default on Windows, because I would like it that the security was present even if there is an attacker there, rather than negotiated. DCOM packet security, you can select how much, whether you want packet privacy or whether or not you want very, very weak security for DCOM connections. Tuning these up from a central endpoint, make sure that you've got a uniform, highly protected network. Actually, DCOM packet privacy, packet security, is something I really do like, because it can be turned up very, very high. And then regularly auditing Active Directory. You can see the new accounts of attackers appear. Another defensive strategy is to use ADFS, Active Directory Federation Services, to provide SID quarantining, where I've got people in a remote office. They need to share data with me, but I don't want them to have accounts on the same domain controller I have. So we synchronize some files up, and we have a federation where they're able to access the same resources I access, but their domain controller doesn't have to have my password equivalent hashes loaded into it. And if they, if someone breaks into their domain controller, they can't add users there that are able to access my, they can't provision VPN tokens for my production network in another country, for example. Long-term prevention. So, you know, if you're going to think kind of ahead in the clouds, you might rethink some global architecture issues. If the attacks really are state-backed, and it's hard to say without someone that you've caught in a way that they're convicted, and that's hard to do with states, you know, leased lines. How do leased lines work again? You go to a company and you say, hi, I'd like a link, and they go and they drop a new fiber, and they go to your house, and they put a fiber, and they drive a truck all the way to China, right, and they string that fiber across. No, they go flip, flip, flip. Here, look, you've got a nice little connection here. It's whatever you paid for, bits per second. Ching. And now, if you really don't trust you know, the government of the country that that's going through, you shouldn't be thinking of that as a safe and secure place for your bits. You should be encrypting that if you want to keep it safe. Unified forests. Unified forests are, you know, this allows you to go to your office in some remote country and log in using your domain account. And that's very convenient, the one time in a million that that happens. But it also means that anyone who breaks into that domain controller can add themselves an account in your far-flung offices, which is not very nice. Direct L3 routing between offices. Let's just have this nice flat structure. It certainly simplifies things, but it might not be... it's certainly an impediment if you get sophisticated attackers inside your intranet. So I already mentioned Active Directory federated domains using WAN accelerators. WAN accelerators are another example of a technology where you can have documents that are cached, and you can register credentials in two different domains that can access the same information. And that way, there's this... Here, I think I have a picture of it here. Yes. So you've got this little overseas DMZ, and you've got a synced file server and a WAN accelerator, and it can recognize these credentials, and it can recognize these credentials, but these aren't on the same layer 3 network. If you can inject users into this DC, you can't inject users into this DC, and that means that this executive's exchange server over here isn't going to be compromised just by a compromise over there. And that means that if you have an attacker inside your network, maybe they're still going to eventually be able to elevate or do something very clever. They're going to have to be noisier. They're going to have to take longer. It's going to push down those numbers in that Drake's equation and you know, increase your chance of catching them and decrease their chance of success. Smart card authentication is another possible thing that in the long term you could consider. One thing that's kind of weird about that is that actually you still have NTLM hashes, so if your attacks that you're worried about are hash passing attacks, that doesn't help with them, but it definitely helps against the brute forcing, because these credentials, unlike normal passwords, don't have to actually be input by any normal human. They're only known to machines, and so they tend to be effectively unbrute forcible because of their extreme complexity. And then upgrading to Windows 7 and 2008 R2, there's some great features in the latest versions of Windows, including restrict NTLM settings, that help mitigate a lot of these problems with the NTLM level attacks. So that's particularly good. So in conclusion, I'm out of time here, but cost benefit. So make sure you understand if something that you're going to do is actually going to help you before you do it, because you really shouldn't, out of fear, just start investing in protection technologies without a plan, because sometimes those things end up increasing your attack surface or making life hard. So if you think that you are the kind of enterprise that might be targeted, and some of the enterprises that have been targeted are rather small, you know, you might have to up your game. And that doesn't necessarily mean that you're going to go and hire a giant team of reverse engineers and incident response experts and software security people, because that's not economically viable. But you are going to have to, you know, try and at least set up your system so that you can detect these kind of attacks and you can reduce your risk. I definitely don't think it's a rational economic choice to try and make your risk zero. But if there's some kind of, you know, big loss that you could face that you can think of, it definitely wouldn't be a bad thing to be able to minimize that somewhat. Know how a change or a product is going to actually affect that risk before you go and make it. Like, make that salesman actually explain to you how this is going to solve a problem? Is this something that helps you detect an attacker while they're inside, or something that prevents the initial exploitation? Right? That does it harden, make it more difficult to elevate privileges? Those are the kind of questions that you need a clear, coherent answer for before you make an investment. There's a lot of economics at play in something like this, because you can't you can't attain perfect security, right? You have to make a reasonable balance trade-off. And unfortunately, a lot of companies seem to be playing at a level that are higher than they're ready for or than they expected. And that's, that's the scary thing that will cause people to buy lots of products that I've just warned you not to do too carelessly. Another thing that you might want to look at is database connections are often unencrypted. Source control systems often use plain text for things. Their job is to share data. That's not necessarily the best security goal. It's great for engineers. Another thing that seems to be a surprise often is that SMB doesn't provide confidentiality. Even in 2010 with SMB v2, you don't get confidentiality from almost any network file sharing protocol, Tahoe, LIFS excluded. And there's web dev, and there's other things that you can set up, but don't think you're getting that stuff for free. It requires a lot of effort to get those kind of guarantees. Unfortunately, a lot of the security solutions we have are sort of underperforming. It makes sense when people are trying to steal credit card numbers to target your defenses against people who are going to try and get short-term monetary gain. We need to be getting a good return on our investment, so you don't want to start doing huge changes to your network environment unless you think that there's going to be some big payoff. And that includes deploying things that I wish would help, but I can't make a good case for. And I find often when I talk with people, IPsec's a great example. You talk to people about IPsec, and they're like, oh, it's magical. It adds encryption. Encryption's good, right? That's secure. But IPsec doesn't have the idea of who you're talking to. It's fantastic if you have a computer in Houston and a computer in Nigeria, and you need to connect through a VPN, and the only two people that should communicate are the computer in Houston and the computer in Nigeria. You create an IPsec group, and if you're either one of those parties, the only other person that knows the key is the other person that you trust. Sweet. If you're in some type of enterprise situation where every domain joined computer has an AD credential or has the ability to make a security association with every other computer, that's just like having no IPsec, right? The barrier there, I attack you, he wants to impersonate you, he just impersonates you, I make a security association with his ID. There's no verifying of the DNS information or the host name or anything like that. With Kerberos, you get service provider name validation. With HTTPS, you get CNAME validation. With IPsec, you get welcome to the club. And if you're in the club, you're just as good as anyone else in the club. That's not almost always that's not the solution to almost every problem, with the exception of a satellite you don't trust for talking between two hosts. Anyway, thanks for coming. This is the Aurora Response Recommendations PDF that we published in January, and I'd be happy to take any questions.